5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition, liftoff.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Clapp, Director of Content for WorkinSports.com, and this is the Work in Sports Podcast. I was struck this week by a response I received on our private Facebook group for fans of this podcast. If you aren't a member of the podcast group, you really should be. Search for the Work in Sports Podcast on Facebook and join in. Well, for those of you that are a member of that group, you probably recognize that I posted in there that I wanted the serious people in this group, the really driven people, to post their 2019 plans, all the steps they were going to take this year to reach their goals of working in the sports industry. I wanted them to post those plans and then allow the rest of us to hold them accountable. There's 1,200 people in there, including myself. I'm in there all the time, and I thought this was a really great idea to have people post the steps they're going to take in order to hit their goals this year and then allow the rest of us to say, hey, how are you doing against this? Have you done this thing? How is this part going? Holding people accountable, because I want everyone to take real steps, real action, not just a bunch of cheap talk. What are you going to do? And not let people get away with not doing it, put it that way. If you're a student, what is your plan? What internships are you going to aim for? What events are you going to volunteer at? What courses are you going to take? What clubs are you going to get involved in? Who are you going to network with? And what informational interviews are you going to set up? And how will all these events help you towards your goal? That is a plan. It's something you can execute and push you toward your ultimate goal. Every step has a meaning and purpose. So I post this call to action and I get a response. Now, this is just one response. Most of the responses were very positive. But one person said, at this point, I don't need a plan as much as I want a foot in the door. Look, I get it. People feel desperate. People are scared. People want their career to appear before them. And when it doesn't happen that way, they get frustrated. A plan takes time. A job is now. I can hear the frustration bubbling up inside this person. I want a foot in the door. I don't need a plan. I want a foot in the door. But here's the honest truth. Things like leadership and love and fitness and your career, they don't just happen. They are a consistent process. They take time and they take many little tiny micro decisions or micro actions that eventually lead up to the point where you get the result you want. You don't go to the gym one day and then come home that night, look in the mirror and say, I did it, I'm fit. You don't just want a job and get a job. It takes steps. It takes consistent, positive action. Now, how do you know what those actions are? Well, think about this for a second. Before you started listening to this podcast, did you know the steps Brian Killingsworth took to become CMO of the Vegas Golden Knights? Or how Nicole Lynn became a sports agent? Or how Mike Judge became the manager of ticket sales for the Cleveland Browns? No, you probably didn't. But now by listening and learning from these experts, you have blueprints. Matter of fact, every expert that I interview says to me, I wish I had something like this when I was coming up in the industry. By conducting your own informational interviews, you have the steps. By networking and interning and following the QA sessions and Facebook Live sessions and all the other great content we share at WorkinSports.com, you have the game plan. What are you going to do with it? Today's guest, Melanie Newman, broadcaster for the Frisco Rough Riders, is one of just 5 female play-by-play broadcasters in professional baseball. And she's amazing. Do you really think that she's achieved what she has by hoping or wanting? No, she worked at it. She set her goals. She made her choices. She relocated. She went after it. Well, I'll let her tell you. Here she is, Melanie Newman, broadcaster for the Frisco Rough Riders. Hi, Melanie. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, you know, just kicking out the new year and getting ready to see what the baseball season holds.
Yeah. So I love having you on the show. I'm really excited to talk to you more about this because you're a young person breaking into the world of broadcasting. You've already made a lot of great headway. One thing, baseball isn't a sport where you can just wing it. I've known a lot of people who can fake it through a basketball game, but baseball is really hard work. The games are long. It's a long season. There are a lot of pauses, lots of strategy that demands some explaining. When did your love of this game start? And why was baseball something that you've gravitated towards?
You know, honestly, I can't why baseball was what it was. I grew up in a football family. I mean, living in Atlanta, my dad attended both Auburn and Georgia Tech. So we were a big gridiron group. I mean, we spent a lot of Saturdays together as an extended family, actually, watching football. But growing up just outside of East Cobb, which is one of the largest year-round baseball complexes, and then having the Braves right down the road with their heyday in the 90s, I just kind of ended up hanging out at the fields every now and then or watching games, and it just started to really spark from there. And as much as I loved other sports and watching them, I really intellectually clicked with baseball. Baseball was the one sport that I was reading more on and trying to understand the minutia of, you know, the little rules and the discrepancies that happen within the game that you don't always see. And it just kind of, it flourished from there. When I got into high school, I was actually part of a program that uses a couple girls every year. We get to actually keep the scorebook, and we're doing all of the videoing and the charting and everything else, and having that hands-on approach with their head coach at the time, with Coach Childress, I just really appreciated having that, you know, no gender bar experience and getting to have the game up close and getting to know what goes into making the game even happen outside of, you know, the players and the coaches on the field themselves. And then by the time I got into college at Troy, the competitive program, I mean, their team goes to regionals almost every single year with the NCAA, and they gave you the ability to work around the team and be a part of it. I joined our sports information department and our broadcasting department and just tried to do the most that I could. Barry McKnight is the play-by-play guy for them, and he's been like a family member to me. You know, let us sit in and listen to calls, was willing to always listen to our work and help us out and give advice where he could. So I've just been very fortunate to have an all-inclusive background where, you know, it wasn't a question of, okay, well, why do you want to do baseball? It's, okay, you want to do baseball? Let me help you understand it. Let me nourish the love that you have for it. And I really just took it off from there and never looked back. I started out as a print major, and it was suggested I try broadcasting, and it finally clicked that, okay, this is what I love and this is what I want to do.
Yeah, so let's dig into that a little bit more. What about that media broadcasting side? It sounds like you figured that out in college, that your love wasn't just baseball. It was also the storytelling and the reporting and the broadcasting side of things. What was it that made you feel complete in that realm? Because I think that's a hard part for people, is like they identify they love sports, but then they don't always know what to do with that. It sounds like you really figured that out while in college. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it is. And what's so funny is I feel like when I talk to other broadcasters, extremely established, or they're still kind of in my pack and trying to carve out a path for themselves, a lot have the same response of, you know, I knew I wanted to do this when I was a kid, or I grew up idolizing, you know, X, Y, and Z broadcaster. And for me, I didn't know that. I thought I would be a vet, and then I thought I would be a teacher. I grew up morbidly shy. I did not speak out loud ever, which a lot of people have a hard time believing now, but I gravitated towards print and being a journalist because I was good at that. I had a very strong background with language and arts and everything else that ties into that. And it was comfortable for me. You know, I don't really have to say much. I can just write. And by the time I got to Troy, the print market was dying. And that was before it had fully made that conversion over to the digital side. And I think people realized, you know, they could create powerhouses still with writing, but it's that it would be all online, like the way The Athletic is today. So I had a professor actually suggest to me, you know, I think you would be a good fit for our broadcast department if you want to give it a try, because that's actually two separate majors at Troy between broadcast and print. It's not just a basis journalism program. So at first to think, okay, well, now I'm going to be in front of a camera and all this other stuff. And then I realized once I started taking the classes and going through the motions of it, how much I loved the challenge. You know, I was sitting in this comfortable space for most of my life. And then all of a sudden it's okay, well, here's a learning curve for you. And get enough of, you know, pushing myself to see how much I could do and how far outside of my previously conceived boundaries I could expand my experience. And it's just, it's always carried that for me through every single job that I've had. You know, okay, well, what's a new edge that I can add this year? What's a new aspect that I haven't previously handled that I could maybe step up and learn from someone else this year, or start to do myself. So I really fell in love with it. And having everyday classes that made you go out in the field and record packages and then shoot stand-ups, and you were critiqued on a frequent basis. And then again, with our SID and our broadcasting department, having several years in NCAA experience getting to sit behind the mic and call a game or do a broadcast for ESPN3, it was huge.
Yeah.
I actually started out wanting to do studio work and hosting, and then had an opportunity to do sideline reporting with the Atlantic Sun Conference. Our boss, Ricky Hazel, had transferred from Troy to Stetson, and I wasn't going to take it. And I told my dad, you know, I said, I don't understand the full value of a sideline reporting position. And my dad pointed out, you know, that, well, if you don't think it adds value, you're being given a chance to add value to it. And granted, when I look back at that now, it's such a narrow-minded mindset to have towards that role, because it's extremely difficult to not only build rapport and to find the storylines that aren't already out there, because anybody can regurgitate an article they found online, but it's another thing to have the respect and the trust of the athletes that you're working around to share their platform and their stories and give them a voice while they're busy out on the field.
I like your dad. That's good advice.
I owe him credit every single time I think about where I am.
That's great. So no one gets hired in broadcasting without a demo reel. It's your proof of performance. Mm-hmm. In my career as a news director, I've probably watched thousands of demo reels, and some of them are just unwatchable. What was your approach to it's so true. I've watched some where people spelled their own names wrong. I'm not kidding. Like, they had a resume and a demo. Oh yeah, I'm serious. They had a resume and a demo reel. So I pop in the tape, or I pop in the CD or the video, or whatever, their link, and it does not match. The name was spelled differently on their resume and on their demo reel. So anyway, some of them are just really bad. What was your approach while in college? You're obviously having to do a lot of projects. You're doing a lot of stand-ups. You're doing a lot of reporting. What was your approach to putting your best of the best together so you could really show yourself to the marketplace?
Honestly, this is something I wish I had a better understanding of before I graduated, because by the time I graduated, I had pieces of what I had done in college, but if I'm looking at the overall scope, I had maybe 2% of my body of work.
Okay.
So my advice to students who are in college is be aggressive about making sure every time you do, whether it's a class project or you're actually getting to college, sport or a Division One sport for your school, getting the audio or the video, the footage, whatever it is, and having that. I wasn't as technologically proficient as I should have been graduating, but I didn't understand that at the time. And granted, my professors did a great job of preparing us for what the real world would be in this industry. You know, just as far as you're going to have to fight for pay. It's not this $80,000 out of the gate type job. You're going to have roommates. You're going to struggle and all that. I understood that. And I think that was also important to know that, you know, it's not glittery
right
in the real world. But to look back and to see that I really didn't get to start building my footage until I was in my first job in Mobile, I could have probably helped myself a little more had I been sure to acquire all of my materials as I was going.
Yeah, that's so
but
important.
But now
yeah.
The biggest aspect of it now is I have Adobe Premiere on my laptop at home. So at my own personal use, anytime now, I'm immediately going through, I'm chopping it, I'm making sure that I turn it around, and I put it on my own personal website, and it's now become this catalog of over 5 years of work, and it's divided, you know, by the year, by sideline, studio, packages, I mean, anything you can think of. And I've been a lot more vigilant about doing that now. I'm actually about to have to sit down and chop up all of the bowl games from December, which will probably be a week, but the quicker you can get that proof of work out there, the more active it shows you are to employers and the more valuable you clearly are.
It's so true, and the tools have changed so much. When I first started in the industry, it was 1996, and the edit bays to do the nonlinear editing, like you're able to do on your laptop now, and I'm able to do on my laptop because I use Adobe Premiere as well, that was an entire like suite of computers. Like it was like this huge system. It was like $1 million. It was this big deal. Yeah. And now it's like on your laptop and you can do it anywhere. You know, you can do it from a Starbucks. It's really cool. So let's talk about Mobile a little bit. Your first gig in minor league baseball was the Mobile Bay Bears, AA affiliate of the Angels. Take us through that early experience. First off, how did you land that job? Because those jobs can be really competitive. How did you get your foot in the door there?
Honestly, is a series of unfortunate events and coincidences. my start in this career, I second-guessed several times before I finally ended up in Mobile. Initially, I had accepted a job with a now-defunct football league and had agreed to be a league reporter, and, you know, X, Y, and Z contracts were signed. And this was probably 5 months after I graduated. And all of a sudden, I woke up to a phone call one day from the man who had been operating as the league's PR director, you know, saying, hey, you need to check your email, you need to check this. And the commissioner of the league had turned out identity fraud and a history, just a rap sheet of horrible things behind him. So effectively, the league folded before it ever started.
Yikes.
Yeah. And I found myself without a job, and I'm now 8 months out of college, and I'm starting to second guess if this is something I even belong in, because again, I hadn't been vigilant in collecting my college footage. So I'm like, okay, now what? Because I don't have the work to show, and I'm that much further removed, which shows that I've just been sitting from the outside view. So I took a job in Texas in this teeny tiny town called Kilgore with another team that's defunct. And 3 or 4 months into the job, I couldn't do it anymore. I was miserable to the point that I wasn't myself. And it took a while to really pull myself in and ask if this job was worth it anymore. And after I counseled with a couple people, including people who had worked there in the past, I decided I'd do some feelers and figuring out a new path. And I got very fortunate that a good friend of mine for the last decade, Justin Baker, at the time was the number one in Mobile. And I called him and I said, hey man, I know it's the middle of the season. I get it. I don't care if it's concession work. Do you have something that every day? I said, I'll do whatever I need to do. And if I can be so lucky to get some type of media work on the side, albeit free of charge, I'll take it. And it just so happened that they had a turnover for their on-field host about a week before I called him. And he said, you know, come on.
Wow.
So I packed up. I went home to Atlanta for about a week, kind of regrouped, and then went down to Mobile and finished out the 2014 season with him. And I was very fortunate in the fact that not only did I come in and assume the role of on-field host, but he started utilizing me to do all the pregame interviews. And then for the road games, I was joining him in the booth, or if, you know, my on-field activities were done for the day at home, I'd go up for the last couple innings and sit in and chat with him there. And having that, I was really just to not only have a broadcast partner who believed in me and really picked me up out of the water and possibly saved my career, but it's very unique to be able to work with a friend as far as just the ease of conversation and the flow of talking about the game. And I really was able to get some critique from him and update my work and really start taking the rust off. And then by the time we started looking at 2015, it was a good fit for us. And so I re-signed for another year with Mobile, and my role expanded from there. A lot of people talk about wearing different hats in minor league baseball. And that year with the Bay Bears, I was a sales executive. I did social media. I was our on-field host for home games. And I did pre and post for home games. And then on the road, I sat in and did color and play-by-play with Justin. Mascot. I was the mascot handler. I did all of our community events and appearances. And then, you know, the beloved tarp crew, since Mobile's one of the rainiest cities in America. But it was fun to really grasp what minor league baseball is and what it takes to put on a game from the front office up. And I think understanding that knowledge now has been that much more beneficial, because you know that, you know, broadcaster isn't just a broadcaster. You know, it still comes down to sales and community engagement and everything else. So having all those different webs really still plays into effect today.
That's the thing I love about minor league sports, and for people to start their career there, is because you do a bit of everything. You know, it's like, it's kind of cliche because we always talk about it, but you know, one night you're doing the pregame, the next you're in sales or you're wearing the mascot suit. So that kind of introduction to the industry, Do you look back at that now and say building that foundation and really understanding the different facets of the business really has set you up for success as you've moved further since then?
Oh my gosh, 100%. And that's been the biggest part about it, is understanding in sports that really sales is the backbone of it. It doesn't matter how well or poorly the team is performing. I mean, the sales team is busting it year round to make that happen. I mean, that's where your initial revenue comes in. That's how players get paid. That's how you get paid. But then also understanding apart from that, and this is where the community side ties in, that you're not selling a hard dollar. You're selling an emotional experience. And it doesn't matter what sport that's in. People go to games for the emotional experience of it, whether it's a memory, a little piece of nostalgia that they hold on to, or the possibility of something happening, or maybe they grew up and they have that memory from their dad. But to see all the different aspects of it and what goes into it, it makes everything. And I tell people that all the time, because when I've talked to several different employers or going into interviews, they say, okay, well, what do you think is, you know, another aspect that you can bring to the game? And sales is the number one push every single time. I mean, that's what it always comes back to. And I have so much more appreciation, especially after being in Frisco this year with such a large staff where I didn't have to wear all those hats. But understanding at the same time what their job entails and what they're going through on a day in and day out. I mean, you have to have that respect for other people in the office, regardless of what your title is, because it's not easy to work in sports. And I don't really care what your job title is. Almost everybody is going through the same. Be there.
Yeah, it's so true. The sales are really the straw that stirs the drink for sports. I mean, every team, you don't sign the big free agent, you don't have the big new arena, you don't have the big Kaneem coach or any of that. If you don't have, you know, great facilities, or you don't get do any of that if you're not selling tickets and sponsorships and all those things. So it's great to get that background, even if it is that your goal is for something much different than that. But to have that knowledge is so important. After you finished up at Mobile, you jumped around for a little bit, which is totally normal when you're getting your career going. Then you see this opening with the Frisco Rough Riders, AA affiliate for the Rangers, as a broadcaster. What was the key to landing that job? What was that experience like?
Honestly, when I read the description online, it just felt like that was my perfect fit, because it gave me a chance to get back in the booth and to have play-by-play, to have color and all that. But to grow and have the relationship they do with Fox Sports Southwest in a sidelines position, I mean, that was huge for me, because ultimately at the end of the day, that's where I'm trying to be, you know, 200 days out of the year. So to look at it from, okay, I get to have a digital hosting aspect, I get the in-booth experience, I get the on-field experience. It was just a mix of everything that I could ideal job description for me, especially at a minor league level. That was it. So I sent out an email. I applied through the website, which is where they were funneling all of their applicants at the time, and then went a step further to send a direct email to the person who was in charge of hiring to say, hey, you know, I sent this through. I'm about this job. And it was funny, because actually at first I found out they had kind of skimmed through it, you know, okay, her stuff's good, whatever. HR was the one who said, okay, wait a minute. I don't think you saw this, but she has play-by-play. It's in her website right here, and it gets to the top of the candidates list, because obviously that's, you have to have the strong ability to do that, since that was a majority of the actual job description itself. We only had about a dozen games where I was fulfilling a sideline role. But the process was easy from there. We got along with the whole front office, had a couple phone calls and a Skype interview, and I had the job, I want to say, before Christmas.
Okay.
So growing up and having family in Texas, having had my first actual job in Texas and growing up outside of Arlington with my dad's family there, it was a natural fit. And having been to spring training in Arizona for the last 5 or 6 years, and the Rangers are out there as well, you know, I know my way around, not only just the Arizona, but the whole Rangers complex itself. So it was just like coming home, basically. I don't know if I'll ever have a transition into a job or an application into a job as naturally fitting as that one was.
So take a look back, be a little bit nostalgic in that first year with the team. What were some of the major things that you feel like you learned? You know, you're in a new scenario, you're learning new players, you're learning new stories, you're learning all their backgrounds, you're doing play by play. What are some of the major things that you take away from that first year of how you kind of refined yourself into becoming the broadcaster you want to be?
I'm definitely that while I was in Mobile, I discovered the Arizona Fall League. I had no idea what it was before 2014. I had never even heard of it. And from that point on, I started flying out there every fall. And it's a mix of all 30 teams. So you start to see all these top prospects that start shaking around. And I got lucky because a decent chunk of the team in Frisco this year were kids that at one point in those past 4 years I had seen already out of the fall league. So to not stop learning either and keeping your eyes open and trying to get used to these names was a huge help. And when I got the job, I asked them, I said, look, I work for the advanced statistics department of Major League Baseball, which entails me working spring training. So would you be all right if I took the month of March to be out at spring training, because I can get up in the morning and go out to the backfield and start to, you know, put faces with names, get to know instructors, coordinators, everybody involved, and really play catch up basically with a program that I haven't really been involved with, and to go from there. And I got very lucky that they approved that, but that was huge. Just to go from feeling like you're behind the eight ball and you've all of a sudden not only have to learn the handful of guys that are, I mean, overall, especially at the AA level, you want to know that organization as a whole, because you're at one of the most fluid stops as far as guys that are coming up and coming up from there. So if you don't understand who they're replacing at the big league level or who's coming to you, I mean, you're going to play catch up all year long and it can be exhausting. So really putting forward the effort to get up early and to go put FaceTime in and not being afraid to ask questions was really special for me. And to have such an inviting group to do that, I mean, Emily Jones, who's with the Rangers, has been one of the best people that I've met in the past year, just as far as, you know, any questions that she could ever answer for me. Or there were never dumb questions, because the thing is, you have to be willing to put yourself out there and ask them and get through the awkwardness of it now, because you don't want that to come out on air.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you know, they can see right through the fact that you don't know who or what you're talking about. But it's those, the quiet moments in the fall league and spring training, me maybe more than the games themselves, because it's the most intimate setting to get the system that you're working for. And, you know, all the people from top to bottom. And again, that's the players and the rehab staff and all the coordinators that can be much easier for you.
So you're one of only five women calling play-by-play in pro baseball. And I've listened to your broadcast, and you are a natural. I'm not just saying that because you're on the phone with me right now. You have a very natural delivery. How would you describe your style, and how have you kind of refined it as you've grown as a broadcaster?
I definitely had to shake off the rust this April, and it was so funny because our first game of the season, we opened up at home and game on Fox Sports Southwest. So I was dealing with all the nerves of, okay, this is my first regional network appearance on television doing my dream job. And then I got through that first game and the nerves kind of reset, because I said, oh my God, okay, tomorrow I have to be in the booth for the first time in 2 or 3 years calling play-by-play, and you know that there's people listening. So it all of a sudden started coming back of all of the little tiny details that you don't think about when you're just watching the game, but all of a sudden they come to life when you realize you're having to be the eyes of the game for so many people. And trusting myself, Ryan Roulard, my partner this year, he was really great at just kind of pacing me through it. You know, okay, hey, today was good. I liked this. Work on this, or, you know, in this part right here. And if I got tripped up a little bit, he would cut on real quick and kind of pick it up for me, which was great until I really got my feet underneath me. But it's just, it's watching every little detail. And for me, it's the play that's going on, but making sure that you're painting what the sky looks like over the game. And, you know, maybe the lights are twinkling out in right field where the apartment complex is, or, you know, the ocean line that goes in the entire outfield in Pensacola, or MGM that's behind Biloxi, and Corpus Christi has 1,000,005 things going on in their field, but really giving people a sense of where they're at while you're still keeping up with everything else that's going on. You know, does Eliezer Alvarez have his neon pink lightning bolt sleeve on his arm today because he's been 3 for 4 his last 2 games when he's worn it, or did he switch it up? And then from there, just trusting yourself. I would be lying if I didn't say that every single game while I'm on air, it's not like an anxiety level, but I'm still a bag of nerves, just making sure every single play I fully capture what's going on, you know, and not losing where the ball has gone, or not forgetting to describe how a player is making a play out in the field, but just ensuring that people are getting the best possible quality from me is huge. Because they're trusting you. And it's not just the people that have hired you who are trusting you, but it's the families of these guys who can't make it out to games, or people who built a fan base here and then moved away and still want to keep up with the game. And you look at so many greats that have gotten the call of a game before we have, and it's a very fortunate situation, regardless of, you know, which gender base you fall in. But I don't take it for granted at all. It's just a matter of being alert every single second, because even though on the outside, baseball can seem like it moves a little slower, and, you know, we keep hearing that today with trying to introduce all the clocks and everything else, the reality of it is, if you're trying to describe every single thing that's going on, it's slow enough, unless there's a stoppage of the game.
Do you have any certain broadcasters that you look up to or you admire their style? Like, who do you listen to and say, wow, they've got it?
Definitely. I think it's hard to, everybody picks Vin Scully.
Oh yeah.
I adore his work. I absolutely do. But I also know at the same time, I'll never emulate him, because I'll never have that. That's not my personality. It's him. And the best thing that I've learned is to not try to, like, you can admire people and listen and watch all day, but don't try to be them. Just try to be yourself, because there's already one of that person. They don't need another one. But he made the game magical when you listen to him. And we got lucky too with the Rangers having Eric Nadell, and, you know, he's a Hall of Fame voice, and just the way he kind of melodically goes over everything, It just makes you feel that magic side of baseball. Ryan put me in a really good habit this year of flipping around and listening to a whole bunch of different people throughout the year. You know, okay, well, I listened to the Cardinals yesterday. Let's pick up on the Marlins today. Really, whoever fit in the schedule with what game we had and what time we were playing. And it just gave me attention to pick up little things here and there, like, oh, okay, I like they did this. Or if they would use a particular word or a way of describing something, I would write it down in this notebook that I keep. Like, okay, hey, so instead of saying this, you can use what they said instead. But at the same time, again, not leaning on that, completely changing your vocabulary for it. From the sideline, I have the most tremendous amount of respect for a lot of the women. But Sophia Minnaert just sticks out the most to me with the Brewers, because her ability to flawlessly on camera run from Spanish to English with a Spanish-speaking player, that's an art form to me. And that's something not only respectable, but desirable to go after as far as equality. I mean, because it's such a huge language in baseball. To be able to communicate with them without the need of a translator just makes everything so much more natural. Out the top to me in that regard. But I mean, overall on the play-by-play experience, I just think every single one of the men and women that are calling right now have just little pieces. And it's kind of like, okay, well, if I can take a little bit of everybody, that's only going to help make me better.
What are the players like? Have they been receptive to you as a young woman, or do you have to go to extra lengths to prove yourself to them? Do you feel like there's an extra, I don't know, pressure put upon, placed upon you to earn their trust, or does that come pretty naturally?
Honestly, it varies with every single team, and I've said it a couple times, but the group that came through Frisco this year was no contest the best that I've ever worked with, just as far as they had that level of respect for me. I never really had to deal with people that were pushing boundaries or being inappropriate. I knew I had a house and talked to our manager, and you know, not even just about the game itself, but about his philosophy towards it. And we had Pudge Rodriguez, who would come down there, and he wanted to take over, was the same way. They were just so eager to impart, you know, whatever pieces they were looking at, whether it was the game as a whole or maybe something they were dealing with that day in particular. And the players were the same way. We'd go out for batting practice, and they were more than willing to come up and chat. If we were on the road, you know, I'd make sure that if they were all at the hotel bar after the game, I could sit there and have a beer with them, and I could understand all these stories. And some of them would even start to come up and say, hey, you know, can I talk to you about this? And they were sure to let me know, like, yeah, feel free to share this, or hey, you should talk about this on air. And that's it's cool. Those little pieces that I would never have if I wasn't physically around them to hear it themselves. And at the same time, understanding that a lot of what I hear and a lot of what I'm told are still personal for them, and it's still not ready to be shared with the outside world yet, and having enough respect for them that they can trust me that I'm not going to share those stories. I think that's the biggest difference that other people don't understand too, is you have to be willing to discern what you can and cannot share, because the minute that you start overstepping your boundaries and discussing, you know, maybe it's a family matter for a player, or maybe they didn't have a good night and they shared their thoughts on it, but they didn't want those thoughts public, and you share them anyways, you start burning those bridges really quickly. And if you burn it with one, it'll go through an entire clubhouse after that, because that's all it takes. Afraid to joke around and to be themselves with me without walking on eggshells, you know, like, oh, I've got to watch what I say around her. But at the same time, they carried a very heavy line of respect. And I think that's not only just a reflection on the organization itself, but on the coaching staff that was put in there. They were very clear from the start how they expect their guys to behave, and I could not have asked for a better group.
Clearly you're enjoying your time with the Rough Riders. I mean, that's pretty obvious, but dare to dream for here for a little bit. What would you say is your big, what would you say is your big goal? Like, where do you see yourself ending up, and what's that driving factor that really pushes you towards that end goal of where you want to be and where you see yourself?
So this question, well, or I should say the answer, frustrates some people because it is a little more open-ended than the way that others will answer it. But after my sentence and having several gigs like these bowl games that I just did with Game Day Radio, or my work with the ACC network, both sides of the gamut, one where you're with a team every single day in and out, and you're able to build and develop and understand it. And the challenge to that being, okay, well, I need a new spin on day 120 of the season versus, you know, dropping in 2 days before an event. You have to put your face in front of all these coaches and players and get them to know that you're the one that's going to be down there talking, and then really familiarize yourself with that team and their culture very quickly before being on air. And I appreciate both sides and I love it to death, but my ultimate goal is just to be with a team where I can fully invest day in and day out. So ideally, because the way the contracts work varies team to team, it would be with a regional network as a team reporter. And, you know, if I have the ability and the freedom and the flexibility to have those days in the booth, the way that the Rockies utilize Jenny Kavnar, but just the challenge of, you know, familiarizing yourself with them, getting them to trust you, building that up, but then also familiarizing yourself with the fan base. What Todd Callis did while he was with Tampa Bay was tremendous because he made himself a part of that community, and he became the face they identified as they could get any news, whether that was, you know, personal human interest story or actual moves and business stuff that was happening with the team, he was the trusted source for that on both ends. And I just think it's such an amazing aspect to get up and to go to work every day and to be a part of that team. And regardless of what city or what team it's with, I'm open to that. I've learned very quickly that you can go anywhere as long as you're willing to put the homework and the studying and the research behind it. But involved and to contribute on a daily basis is my end goal at this point.
I think it's a great goal. We have a lot of fans in our audience who want to work in broadcasting, who want to work with a team. So what's one thing you would suggest for an aspiring broadcaster as you look back on what you've accomplished, but also, you know, mistakes you've made or things you would have done differently? What's one piece of advice that you would help share for some other aspiring broadcaster to help build their brand and make themselves a credible hire?
I think it ties in a couple different ways, but just being willing to say yes. I've still taken unpaid gigs, and I've never really turned anything down unless I absolutely could not do it. And, you know, sometimes it is daunting, especially if a new sport is presented to you. Don't turn it down because that's not the state you want to live in, or that's not the sport you want to cover. I found tremendous amounts of joy taking sports that were extremely terrifying at the thought that I had to come off as knowledgeable about it. And it was just a matter of buckling down and studying and learning how it operates. And that's the same goes with TV stations. I think in the sports industry, a lot of people just look at the teams themselves and want to be involved directly with that. But TV station work can be tremendously helpful. And I've told several of the girls that I've mentored or who have interned with me that I wish graduating from college, I had looked a little more seriously into working or interning with a station. It's stable work and everyday practice, not only to talk about sports, but to go out and film them and to keep your technological components sharp in that regard, because no matter where you end up, people are still curious about that end of your skill set. Yes, and being willing to gut it out. And if that means that you have to pick up a couple jobs on the side that aren't broadcasting, but you know what you want to do at the end of the day, then just do it. I'm still bartending 11 years later. I'm still substitute teaching. I'm still doing a million little things on the side. I mean, I filed taxes in 7 different states last year. And it was just a matter of, okay, well, I love my broadcasting job so much. I'm not meant for anything else on this earth other than that. Pay the bills. So where can I find the source of income to make that happen? And it's a lot of nights of no sleep and a lot of nights of traveling. I've put 110,000 miles on my car in 2 years. And I would not trade any of it for the world. And I think if you have that in your heart and you know that this is where you're cut out to be, then do whatever it takes to make it work. And again, like you and I talked about, having the ability to cut work on your own laptop now is huge. So if that means going out on a day that you don't really have anything going on and wearing 5 different blazers and make-believe stand-ups, but cutting them and editing them and making them look professional just to put new content on your website and making sure that you're consistently churning that out and networking that, you can make it work. You just have to stick with it, and you have to accept the nights of tears and the McDonald's meals and everything else that goes in with that. But at the end of the day, every single struggle and setback and time that, you know, I've had to turn down something fun with my friend, this has all been worth it.
Melanie, this is great stuff. I really appreciate your honesty and your raw approach to your journey and just your willingness to share and be transparent about the different things that have happened as part of your story. I know our audience is going to love this, and I just really appreciate the time you've given us today.
Thank you so much.
Trust me, after spending most of my career in sports broadcasting, I know how tough a road it can be to break through. It is not an easy plight. But for those like Melanie that have it in their blood, they can't imagine anything else. Thank you so much to Melanie for coming on the show. You should check out Melanie's work at her website, which is melanielynn.com. That's M-E-L-A-N-I-E-L-Y-N-N-E-N.com. Trust me, you'll enjoy it. Her work is really, really good. And connect with her on LinkedIn. She's vowed to make that a part of her plan in 2019. Thanks for tuning in. Make sure to join the Work and Sports podcast group on Facebook and tune in for the Facebook Live sessions that we do every Thursday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern from the Work and Sports Facebook page. Now, go get to work.